And the way we proceeded was we wrote down the action, which is a functional of both psi and the metric. Once the fields and the metric are given, you can work out a number, the so-called action. And this was some bounded closed region of the time. Then, requiring that the variation of the action with respect to any of the matter fields is vanishing, gave us the order Lagrange equation, which are the equations of motion for the matter field. By the way, if we had defined here an overall prefactor, let's say if we took an action and we multiplied it with 27, how would that affect our equations of motion? Not at all, right? Because it would drop out here. And yet, you remember we had in front of the electromagnetic action, for example, a prefactor of 1 over 16. Why 1 over 16? Somebody's favorite number or what? Well, it turns out that gravity will be sensitive to this. I mean, the thing is that we will need an action for gravity too, and then the relative factor between the matter action and the gravity action will be important. But also, quantum theory, of course, will care about this, because every configuration of psi and g gets assigned a probability amplitude, which is e to the power of I action over h bar. And if you multiply the action by 27, it would make a difference. It would effectively rescale the Planck function. So therefore, the overall factor does matter in the quantum theory and in general relativity, whereas practically it doesn't matter. Only the relative sizes of the action between electromagnetic fields and Pangolin fields, for example, would matter, but not the overall factor. But in quantum theory, the overall factor does matter. Yeah, that's just what I said. See, the overall factor does matter because in quantum theory, every configuration of psi and g gets assigned a probability amplitude, which is up to normalization constant e to the power of I, the action divided by h bar. So any prefactor that you put on the S or the L effectively would change h bar. But we know that h bar has a certain value. So then we ask, how does the action, and remember the action describes or gives you the equations of motion for all matter fields, we ask, how does this action change as we change the shape of the manifold? How does the action change with g? This tells us ultimately, how do the equations of motion of matter fields change with g? So we define the variation of g. So we had g of lambda and x. If lambda is equal to 0, we are back to the usual g. If lambda is not equal to 0, then it's some deformation of the manifold. But we require that the metric is the usual metric whenever we are outside the region B. Then we say that S, the action, is functionally differentiable with respect to the metric in the region B, if this makes sense, if this is existing for all smooth deformations of the shape of the manifold that is of G. And then we said that if that thing exists, it is of this form. The variation of the action with respect to the metric is some tensor, T mu nu, times the variation of g. Strictly speaking, this is not a tensor. And the reason is that we don't have a volume form here. But the square root of g is. So strictly speaking, the definition of such a derivative is just an analytic definition. It doesn't know about geometry, differential geometry, curvature, anything of that kind. And the derivative is simply straightforwardly defined as being the derivative of S with respect to lambda is simply some tensor, and that's a collection of all the terms that you get when you work it out, times the variation of G, and the whole thing integrated over D4x. So this thing, since the whole thing is covariant, this thing has to have a square root of G built into it. And any tensor multiplied with the square root of G is a tensor density. I think we mentioned that before. So this thing is going to be a tensor density. And once we pull out the factor of square root of G out of it, then we will be able to call it a tensor. So this T mu nu is the so-called energy momentum tensor density. And we will write ds by dg is 1/2 T mu nu. That's the energy momentum tensor, tensor density. And then, if we divide this thing with respect, by square root of V, we obtain a tensor, right? Because T mu nu times square root of V is what we would have up here then, right? So this tau mu nu is T mu nu times square root of V. And therefore, you have T mu nu square root of V times that D4x, and that means that the T mu nu is a tensor, not a tensor density. So T mu nu, the energy momentum tensor, is given by 2 over square root of V, the functional derivative of S with respect to V. Let's look at an example. Let's look at the Klein-Gordon field with some potential here. Usual thing of covariant derivative, metric, potential, and volume form. The potential could be, for example, psi squared plus some coefficient psi to the fourth power. I wrote here covariant derivative, but do I really have to write covariant derivative here? Could I not just write ordinary derivative? Good, because what is the covariant derivative of a scalar? Psi is a scalar function, right? And covariant derivative for scalar is just ordinary derivative. So it's sometimes useful to know, to keep that in mind, because it means we don't have to bother with the surface symbols. It's just ordinary derivatives, and it's, you know, ordinary derivatives have some nice properties. So what is then, for the Klein-Gordon action, the energy momentum tensor? Right? We have to differentiate the action with respect to lambda at lambda equals 0. And then, well, what do we get? And we get one term here from the potential. There are three occurrences of dependencies on the metric in this. There are three terms that depend on the metric, or three ways in which this depends on the metric. This, of course, is a metric dependence, but this term is multiplied with that. So by the product rule, we will also have to differentiate with respect to this. So this term will give us two terms when we differentiate with respect to G, and that term will give us one term because it's multiplied with this thing. So again, we get a derivative here. And since these are really just ordinary derivatives, they don't depend on the metric. So we don't have to worry about these guys when we functionally differentiate with respect to the metric. That's the specialty of dealing with scalar field. Okay, so what do we get? We have this term multiplied by that, functionally differentiated with respect to G. That gives us one term where we differentiate this thing, that's this term. We get one term where we functionally differentiate this, where we differentiate that particular term, that this thing here. And then, as we said, we get the functional derivative of this with respect to G, that here, not here, that gives us that term. The derivative of the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of V with respect to the metric is this expression. We had that at the end of the last lecture. And also, a useful little trick is the following. Take GAB and contract it with GBC. Well, what is that? That is simply G, one lower index A, one upper index C, which is delta AC. But the variation of the identity, this is just delta AC, is zero. But on the other hand, by the Leibniz rule, it is the derivation of this times that plus this times the variation of that, which is these two terms. So we see that the variation with upper indices is related to the variation with lower indices via a minus, because the whole thing has to be zero. So there's a thing to keep in mind, because we have those the variation with respect to upper indices here. Okay? So overall, we obtain these terms now. This comes from the this is that term, variation of the upper indices gives us for this, that expression here. Then we have that term over here. And finally, the term with the potential is over here. Therefore, we can read off what the energy momentum sensor is, or maybe not so fast. This is the energy momentum sensor density, simply collecting all the terms together from up here. And from that, we obtain the energy momentum tensor simply by multiplying with 2 and dividing by the square root of g. So as we do this, we obtain that the energy momentum tensor for the Klein-Gordon field is this expression. Now, this tensor here is as a matrix. It's a matrix with 2 components, labeled mu and nu, and it's symmetric. You see, if you interchange the 2 labels mu and nu, get the same thing. And here, of course, that's a symmetric thing as well. And that's contracted anyway. So the whole thing is symmetric under exchange of mu and nu. This is an important thing. We need this in order to be able to write down the Einstein equation later on. There are other methods of arriving at energy and momentum that are much used in classical theory, but cannot be used for this purpose here in general relativity. For example, you could take the Lagrangian and do a Legendre transform in order to get the Hamiltonian. In this way, what you obtain is the Hamiltonian which generates time translation. This is what the Legendre transform will guarantee for you. But this is not the same as the zero-zero component of the energy momentum interface. So basically, in general relativity, you could completely forget about the Legendre transform. Never use this. This is the way to define the energy momentum transform. And you will see later why this is the right. I leave it to you as an exercise to work out the energy momentum tensor for the electromagnetic field, which comes out to be. Now, for cosmology, very important is the case of a perfect fluid. A perfect classical fluid, according to the thermodynamic definition, would be a fluid that has reversible dynamics, a reversible dynamic in principle. But you can also view it this way. A perfect classical fluid has at every point a unique time-like flux direction vector. So it's like air, where the air is flowing in this room, let's say, and at every point you can say in which direction the air is moving. Not trivial, because you could imagine that some of the air molecules will go this way, and some others won't care and go that way. And since the density is low, I mean, assuming the density is low, they might not even interfere very much with another. So you could have a fluid which is going through itself, like smoke in air. Right? You can have that the air flows this way, and you can still have some smoke going a little bit differently. I mean, for example, you could have some stuff suspended, which then flows, like smoke. Just think of tiny, tiny snowflakes that don't have to follow the flow of everything else. So perfect fluid would have at every point a unique forward time-like direction vector v mu, where v mu is equal to minus one, let's say, which is to say that it has essentially the same mass density every, because what that in essence is like t mu, right? T being the momentum. This is like the velocity. In magnitude of the mass, you have p mu equal to m squared t to the square. M squared t squared, that's what it is. Right. So for perfect fluid, the flux is also conserved. So you know, you don't create any fluid or lose any fluid. And the fluid is completely characterized by its local energy density mu and by its local pressure p, which is to say that it doesn't have any shear and no viscosity. In cosmology, that's important. For example, in a situation where we would have something like dust, which is a pretty good, it's often pretty good, often pretty well described in this way. Not always. You can imagine, you know, a dust cloud going this way, another one going the other way. It wouldn't capture it with a perfect fluid description. It would just pass through another path. Okay, then let us ask, what is the energy momentum tensor for perfect fluid? Now that can be taken over from special relativity, where the energy momentum tensor for perfect fluid is given by the energy density, which is the same as the mass density, plus the pressure and v mu v mu, plus the pressure v mu mu. It would take us too far to derive this different mechanism. Now it turns out that the equation of motion for such a perfect gas is the following. It is that T mu nu covariantly differentiated with respect to nu summed over nu is equal to zero. There is an important special case. Consider the special case where our perfect fluid consists of particles that don't collide and have no pressure. So that the whole gas has no pressure. So it's like a very, no, just like that. In this case, T is equal to zero. And then you can ask, does this equation mean, this is the equation of motion for the overall dust. What does it mean for the particles that make up the dust? Well, it means that they travel on geodesics, as one can show. We won't go into it, I just want you to know that this is so. Now, so that would be the traditional definition of what is a perfect fluid coming from fluid mechanics. But in cosmology, sometimes terminologies change. For example, even light is considered matter. There's gravity and there's the rest. Everything else is matter, including light. And so also in gravity, there's a terminology that goes back to Hawking and Ellis. And that terminology is that whatever system you have, whatever sort of matter or whatever fields it might be, if the energy momentum tensor has this form, then it's legal to call it a perfect fluid, or at least perfect fluid-like, as long as it has this type of energy momentum tensor. This will be very important because the so-called inflaton field will, as we will see now, or very soon, behave like the perfect fluid, very similar to perfect fluid under certain circumstances. And it's not consisting of a dust at all. It's just a field. And there are no velocities in it. But its energy momentum tensor looks very similar to that of dust. Now, for a perfect fluid, remember there are two key parameters. There's the mass density and the pressure. I mean, the energy density and the pressure. There's a definition now, which is very important if you want to follow any talk on cosmology nowadays, especially the universe cosmology. And that is the equation of state of a perfect fluid. The so-called equation of state of a perfect fluid is simply a definition, really. It is the relation between the energy density and the pressure. So we say that W is equal to P over mu. In practice, in thermodynamics, often because of the nature of the perfect fluid, this might be an equation that is imposed as a law of nature. But in cosmology, you will see that it has a different status. It is more like an indicator. It's more like an instrument that tells you, you know, what sort of where we are in evolution or something. We can just take it as a definition. It's still called the equation of state in cosmology, but it doesn't have the status of a law necessarily. It can also be viewed as simply a definition of this ratio. We call that ratio of energy density, of pressure versus energy density, can call this ratio W. So that is the equation of state parameter W. So what will be very important for cosmology later on is the following observation. The energy momentum tensor that we calculated for Klein-Gordon field can be very similar to the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. And this is the basis of a lot of terminology where people would say that the inflaton field has such and such pressure, which does such and such to the universe, you know, pressure expands the universe, and so on. This is relying on this analogy here. At the moment, if you look at it, it doesn't look all that close. Right? It doesn't look so similar. But we'll have to make a little assumption, and then we'll see that they are quite similar. Especially compared to, for example, the electromagnetic energy momentum tensor, which looks nothing like that. So the key assumption that we have to make, and which is actually quite well satisfied in cosmological models, is that the spatial derivative of the psi field is nearly zero. So the psi field in cosmology is the inflaton field, a scalar field that is supposed to have been very important at the very early stages of the universe. And the assumption is that its spatial variation was very, very small. In fact, technically, one thinks that it's not an assumption, really. If you, the idea is this, the inflaton field might have started out in a very wavy way. However, the inflaton field triggered an explosive expansion of the space-time, which meant that all wavelengths were dramatically stretched out, so that all derivatives really became very small, very quickly, because the expansion was very, very quick. So due to the mechanism of inflation that we will get to at the end of this course, this is thought to be not really that much of an assumption. It's thought to be an outcome of a more fundamental assumption, namely that inflation triggered an explosive expansion. So if we now assume that psi is nearly homogeneous, meaning nearly constant in space, it will have a non-trivial dynamic in time, of course, but in space, it's pretty much constant. Then, let us identify the V mu of the perfect fluid case with this expression here, basically a normalized version of the covariant derivative of psi, which is the ordinary derivative. And this square root is simply the normalization. Remember that the V mu is minus 1. So if we do that, then the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor takes this form. There's really no calculation. We simply substituted for the psi comma mu the V multiplied with the square root here. And since we get two square roots, we just get an absolute value here. And V mu, plus V mu, and this business here. On top of that, we now assume that the spatial variation is very small, pretty much constant in space, so that of all those derivatives, which by the way are ordinary derivatives, even though I wrote semicolon here because it's simply scalars that you're differentiating, of all those derivatives, only the time derivatives survive. The space derivatives are assumed to be negligible. And then we obtain here psi dot squared mu mu v mu, v mu, and this. This now looks relatively similar to that. It's a v mu term with something in front, which we identify as mu plus t. Okay? And we get a g mu mu term, which we identify with t. So that comparison now tells us that mu plus t over p, remember that we were here, mu plus t over p is the term in front of the dv divided by the term in front of the g mu mu. So we have that mu plus t over p by time. Yeah, so we obtain that mu plus p over p is equal to the term in front of the dv term, and divided by t, which is the term in front of the g mu mu term. But remember that mu plus p over p is 1 over w plus 1. Okay, because mu over p is 1 over w. So we obtain that 1 over w is this. This is just another way of writing 1. Okay? And therefore, that. This is a key equation now. A very important equation for all of cosmology. You obtain that the w parameter, the ratio between the pressure and the energy density, is given for a Klein-Gordon field by this ratio here. Now, W parameter is going to be very important when we calculate the evolution of space-time, whether it's going to expand, if it expands, just a second, if it expands, how fast it will expand, and so on.
Being homogeneous, was that really necessary to establish the parallelism between the where was that necessary?
Yeah, good point. If we didn't do that, yeah, we would have extra terms here with spatial derivatives, and they would come in with a different sign. They would see the time derivatives come in with one sign, space derivatives would come in with the other sign.
Okay.
So space derivatives play the role of a potential here. In other words, the space derivatives have to be small compared to the potential.
This just
or compared to the kinetic time.
So this just says that the Klein-Gordon field can behave like a perfect fluid with
yes,
this omega w.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So what is done in practice is that what we calculate the dynamics of the interaction, the interplay between a Klein-Gordon field and space-time.
And we will simplify the discussion by saying that the Klein-Gordon field can be treated the same way that a perfect fluid would be, with a certain P and with a certain mu. And in fact, it turns out that the only thing that matters for a perfect fluid, the only thing that matters when it comes to calculating what it does to space-time, whether it expands it and at what rate it will expand it, is this parameter W. If W is large, it will do one thing to space-time. If it is small, it will do another thing to space-time. So only that matters. And so this is a real shortcut way of seeing what a scalar field will do to space-time, assuming that it is spatially pretty much homogeneous. And what do we see here for the W parameter? We see that it has to be between minus 1 and plus 1. Because assume the kinetic term is dominant. So the psi dot squared is much bigger than the potential. Well, in that case, forget about the potential. It's just one thing over the same thing. It's just plus 1. On the other hand, if the value of the potential is much bigger than the time derivative, then forget about the kinetic terms here. It's just minus V over V, so it's minus 1. Okay? Now, for early universe cosmology, something intriguing is going on nowadays. It turns out that we describe things very well by assuming that there was a period in which W was very close to minus 1, which may sound reasonable. It just means that the potential was dominant for a little while, so the interton potential was dominant, and that meant W was minus 1, and as you later see, W close to minus 1 means explosive expansion. If W is close to minus 1, the space-time will exponentially inflate, exponentially grow. So what we see here is that if we can argue that there was a scalar field in the universe, or is a scalar field in the universe, which very early on had a stretch where it was spatially relatively constant, so that it wouldn't mess up the argument. So it was spatially relatively constant, and its value of the potential, V of psi, was elevated. So psi had a value such that the potential was elevated. Then that would lead to an explosive expansion. It's just a preview. We will see exactly how that comes about. Intriguingly, the experimental data give us for W a value that is very close to minus 1 with some error bar, and the error bar stretched below minus 1. Some people make a big deal out of this and say maybe it's smaller than minus 1. But you see, that would really burst the whole framework here, because we cannot go below minus 1. No way. The smallest it can go is minus 1, when V is completely dominant over that. So it would take some very special circumstances to get the W that's smaller minus 1. And as we will see, if, for example, in the future, you know, we are now apparently also in an exponentially inflating phase of the universe. Not fast exponential, but still, the cosmological constant dominates, as it seems to. Then W is actually pretty negative. You're pretty close to expansion. If W were, just as a preview again, if it were smaller than minus 1, it would mean that the universe would not just keep on expanding exponentially. No. It would actually rip apart in finite time. So everything that is a finite distance now would reach an infinite distance in finite time. It would be a big rip. That's what the implication would be if W is smaller than minus 1. All right, just preview, all coming up. Okay, now in special relativity, energy and momentum, conservation laws, arise through Noether's theorem, expressing that space-time is always and everywhere the same, and that comes from time and space translation invariance. We already mentioned that a little bit. Now, in general relativity, we have two things to consider. First of all, the theory, that is the action, everything about the theory is encoded in the action, after all. The theory is invariant under all diffeomorphisms, which means that we can choose whatever coordinate system we like. Remember that in general relativity, since it is built on differential geometry, we can choose whatever charge we want. This is different from Newtonian mechanics, where Newton's laws initially are formulated for Cartesian inertial coordinate system, but not so in general relativity. Any charge will do. It doesn't matter which charge you want to use. And this is one of those farmer with the cows kind of statements. Right? What we say here is that the laws of nature take the same form in whatever coordinate system you write them down. This is a precise statement. It could be different, but this is what it is. The thing is that we don't expect this to be different in nature, because it would mean that nature cares about our Jacobian system. Unlike, so it's not really a deep statement about nature. It's a statement about us. It's saying that we allow ourselves to describe space, times, and laws of nature in whatever coordinate system we like. So it's sort of an empty statement, but it is a statement. It's a mathematical statement, not a physics. Not a physics statement, but a mathematical statement. And as such, this statement is not giving us a conservation law. It is not giving us an equation of motion. It gives us a Bianchi identity. It gives us one of those equations that holds because of the mathematical framework that we chose. It's still useful to have them to, you know, transform calculations to help with this or that calculation. It's useful to have them, but they are not laws of nature. Secondly, sometimes we may have a special case where locally space-time may actually be the same in some direction. It may not change, actually. We may have a symmetry. It doesn't mean that space-time has to be flat in some direction. It could just be curved, but the curvature doesn't change. Right? And that would mean that if you do the experiment here, or there, or there, it will always be affected by the curvature. But the curvature is the same, and therefore the law of nature for the matter field is actually unchanged as we go along. If that happens, then you have a true symmetry. And that will correspond to so-called Killing vector fields, and they will lead to conservation laws. Because that is, of course, a physical statement, namely that space-time may have the same curvature everywhere in some direction or in some patch, or may have the same curvature over time. All those things would be physics statements that translate into actual physical equations with contrast, and they would be conservation laws. So, as I indicated before, those two things will have to be disentangled. What is the Bianchi identity and what is the conservation law? So, first of all, the relabeling of coordinates, so simply going from one chart without bars to another chart with bars, is something we can always do. And this has four freely choosable functions. You see, if you have four variables, four dimensional space-time, then the barred variables, each one, x1 is, or x0 bar, is a function of those four variables. Then x1 bar is a function of those four variables, and so on. We have four of them, so we have four freely choosable functions when we go from one chart to another. So what we expect is that the freedom to be able to choose those coordinates any whichever way we want should translate into some equation. But we expect this not to be a conservation law, because it's about mathematics, not about the physics. It's about the ability to relabel things. And what are those equations? We expect, since there are four freely choosable functions, we expect this to turn into four equations. And here they are. So the statement is that this relabeling invariance, this diffeomorphism invariance, means that the covariance derivative contracted with mu are in zero. It looks like a conservation law, but it's not. In fact, it turns out that this will be, as we will later see, a contracted version of the Bianchi identity that we had before. Remember the Einstein tensor, g mu nu, semicolon nu, sums over nu is equal to zero? And I said that this is a very important equation that guided Einstein into guessing what the equations of motion of general relativity are. It turns out that this equation is that equation. And remember that this was the Bianchi identity. It traced back to a Jacobi identity for operators. Yes, next step.
Sorry.
All right. So assume now that phi index t is a map from the manifold into the manifold and is a diffeomorphism that is generated by the flow of a vector field xi. Remember, you have a flow of a vector field and you can generate it, and it defines where you want to map the manifold into the manifold. Every point is mapped into a point along that flow. And let's assume that the whole thing plays out just in a finite region V inside the manifold. So the vector field vanishes outside that region, and so the flow is only mapping points inside that region into points inside the region. In other words, we change charts only in the path. And the new coordinate system is the same as the old coordinate system outside the planet. It's just inside the field changes the same. Okay, so what we have is that the diffeomorphism maps the manifold into the manifold. And if the point in question is outside
the region B, so it is in the complement of B in M, then the map phi t maps the point p into itself. Just to say that this flow is mapping the inside of the region into the inside in a non-trivial way, but the outside of the region is just staying the same. It's a limited change of coordinates. So now we have that every integral, including the action integral, is invariant under the change of variable. Remember that if you write down an integral, and it need not have to do anything with physics, just write down any integral. If you change variable in it, you change variable. You don't change the integral by changing variable. You just have to do the proper thing, change variable, and check how the method changes, how the integration limits change and everything. If you just change variable, that doesn't change the value of the integral, right? Similarly here, take the action integral, and we change variable. The change of variable doesn't do anything to the action. So here, we change variable under the diffeomorphism phi t. Remember, it maps point to point. And we can do that even if the diffeomorphism is infinitesimal. So the action integral of a region here is the same when expressed in terms of the old variables or when expressed in terms of the new variables. Anything, right? Same integral. But this can be written as the fact that this is equal to that can be written as the fact that this is that minus this is equal to zero. Because phi star inverse applied to the Lagrangian is simply the pullback of that function into the old coordinate system. Now, for infinitesimal t, this is going to be, basically we can expand this L and see what that will give. So we get a dL by d psi against me? I'm wondering about. Yeah, sure, sure. No, this is just the. Sorry. Okay. You see, what this is like the Newton-Leibniz limit, right? If you take the function and the function at the displaced place, and divide it by the distance, and let the distance t go to zero, you would get the Newton-Leibniz derivative, right? So that would be the derivative, and that is what you, that is exactly what you have here in the Taylor expansion. You take the first derivative and then multiply with the distance. So this is like df by dx times x plus h minus x. If h is that displacement parameter. And we have to differentiate, we have to take the full derivative of L with respect to everything that changes as we apply the diffeomorphism, as we go along the flow. And L depends on two things. L depends on all the vector fields, all the matter fields, and L depends on the metric. So we differentiate with respect to the matter fields and look at their first order change, and we differentiate with respect to the metric and look at its first order change. And the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the matter field is zero when we look at fields which obey the equations of motion, because that gave us the Euler-Lagrangian equation. So that first term here is vanishing. And for the second term here, we realize that dL by dg is what we calculated before. And remember now that this is the full derivative of L with respect to D, all occurrences of D, just like this was the full derivative of L with respect to psi, all occurrences of psi, even the Cobain derivatives of psi. So this was really two types of terms. But in any case, the whole thing is that. So we remember that this derivative, the L by dG, gave us the energy momentum tensor. And this is simply the linear change in the metric divided by 1 over t gives us in the limit the lead derivative of the metric. Remember that when you take a tensor and you displace it with the flow, and then you compare, you take a difference between the tensor here and the tensor over there flowed back, and that's what we have here, and divide it by the distance and let the limit go to zero as we do here, then you get the lead derivative. The lead derivative is defined as the change of a vector with respect to the flow defined to a vector field.
It is true if we are restricting attention to fields which obey the equations of motion. This is an important consideration, because if I'm a field theory, you cannot generate a surface, because you would have all fields in the game and not just those disobeying the equation of motion. So the conclusion that we can draw is that zero equal to this, and in the limit we have zero equal to energy momentum tensor from here and lead derivative of the metric over there, if the fields that we are considering obey the equations of motion.
No, I mean the first step where you wrote, where you wrote the 0 is equal to 1 by t integral Lagrangian minus 5 t star minus inverse n t star. That is not, it is intuitively clear, but it is not by that.
Yeah, but you see, this is that, right?
Or why the factor of 1 by t?
Oh, no, I just put that in there. You could do it without it, it's really true. I put it in there because later on we want to divide it by t and then let the limit t go to 0. And then consider the limit for t going to 0. You see, the statement is this is the same as that equal to 0.
So this t is not
true if you multiply it 1 over t.
So this statement is not the time t. This t is not the time t. It just
one on top of t. This is the parameter of the flow along the flow generated by the vector.
So so in that first line, those two Lagrangians are the same.
Yes.
Then yeah, goes to one. Sorry. So when we change the coordinates, how can we mathematically derive the second?
Sorry, statement. What was the question?
So in the second statement, we have one of the coordinate systems. We have x.
Yes.
We don't have x bar anymore.
Right, but you remember that what the phi star is doing is it is changing the coordinates. That is what it does. Mm-hmm. So in the limit, then, when t goes to 0, we obtain this equation here. And this is going to be an important equation because it contains the lead derivative of the metric and it contains the energy momentum, right? And then we need to pay attention to this point. We will need a lemma for the metric connection, which is to say for that connection which or for the Lipschitz iterator connection, the connection that is
corresponding to a given metric. The lead derivative can also be written in this way. Remember that we had a different formulation for the lead derivative before, because we defined the lead derivative before we even had the covariant derivative. But it turns out that the lead derivative can also be written in this way with the semicolons, with the covariant derivative, even though we had an equation without covariant derivatives. So how come? Well, we know that the expression is true for ordinary derivatives. If we just used ordinary commas, then we would get the expression of the lead derivative for a regular tensor. So how come we are suddenly allowed to write it with a semicolon? Well, it's the usual argument again. We know that this equation holds true without the semicolon, just with the ordinary comma, at the origin of a geodesic coordinate system, for example. And we know that whatever holds this comma in a geodesic coordinate system and is covariant doesn't depend on a geodesic coordinate system, has to have semicolon. And therefore, we can lift it also to arbitrary coordinates. So let us keep that in mind, that the lead derivative can be written in this way, with or without the semicolon. Now we have this equation here. This is what we just derived, that the contraction of the energy momentum tensor with the lead derivative of the metric in the direction of the vector field is zero. Now the lead derivative, from what you just had, the expression of the lead derivative of an arbitrary tensor is the covariant derivative of that tensor times psi k plus those two terms. Just a special case of what we had up here, And in our case, we have covariant indices, so it's the plus sign down here. Okay, so the lead derivative of the metric is the covariant derivative of the metric plus those terms here. But the covariant derivative of the metric is actually vanishing, because remember this is what this equation is what expresses the link between the affine connection and the metric. If the affine connection is describing the same manifold as is the metric, then this equation must hold. The metric, when parallel transported, cannot change. So that term is absent, and we are left with simply those two terms. We can put that back now into our equation. Remember, we had this equation here, this equation, and now we plug in what we have for the lead derivative of the metric. The lead derivative of the metric is this. Multiplied with the energy momentum tensor, multiplied with the square root of g, that's what we get. Yeah, it doesn't matter, you can multiply with two or multiply with zero. This 1/2 only came from the definition of the anthropometry. Okay, so we plugged it in here. And, you know, what is that? We can pull down this index, pull down that index, and we have it in this form here. Now, that is a symmetric combination here. It looks as if it's a symmetric combination here, but it's not quite, because this is a semicolon in between. But what we can do is we can write this as 2 times psi b semicolon a, and then we subtract that again. So we have, you know, we have twice this minus 1, so we have it 1, plus this. And what we have now is an equivalent expression. This is the same as that. But this is the same expression up to minus sign if we interchange A and B, which makes it anti-symmetric, right? But the energy momentum tensor is symmetric, which means that the contraction of this is that is 0. So we can replace those two terms by just one term. You see, when we interchange this piece, we pick up the minus sign. And that doesn't matter because it gets projected out and contracted a bit. So overall, we obtain that 0 equal to this if the equations of motion hold. It's a bit lengthy here. Okay, so that's our equation now. But the perspective here is a little bit awkward as we need all these together. All right, so what do we do here? We just added this and subtract the same thing. Okay, simple. So that's this term here. And this is just some term we added and subtracted again, so we have the same story here. But the advantage is that those two terms combine to be that thing here. Okay? Just covariant to differentiate PAB psi B. By the Leibniz rule, you get one term where you differentiate this. That gives us this term here. This is not a J, this is a semicolon. And another term where we keep the T and differentiate the psi, that gives us this term here. Minus that term. Now the claim is that this whole thing is vanishing. And why is that? Well, let's give this thing a name here. It's RA. And remember we did a trick like this in the first hour today. This thing is a vector RA semicolon A, which means that it's the divergence of something, this whole thing. So we have the divergence of something, but the divergence of something is always, the divergence of a vector K is always the exterior derivative of the inner derivation of the volume form. But since we have the exterior derivative here, we can get rid of the exterior derivative and go to the boundary of the integration region instead. So that means we get the interior derivative, the inner derivative of the volume form here. The volume form is, of course, just square root of v4x. And we integrate it over the boundary of the region. But as before, we actually do not vary on the boundary or beyond. So our coordinate system is actually fixed. It is not being varied. Our diffeomorphism maps the boundary of the region into itself already, so that we have no contribution from this term. So therefore, we are left with saying that 0 equals to this. So what we have finally is that this expression here is 0 for all vector fields psi. But since that's to be true for all vector fields psi, this has got to mean that it's got to be true per se, independent of, I mean, you can get rid of the inequality in the psi. So this was a mere consequence of diffeomorphism in there. We assumed no physics. There was no physical assumption. We simply started with a statement that it's in an integral, in this case the actual integral, you change coordinates. You're not changing the value of it. And then the rest was just straightforward manipulations, and we ended up with this statement. Therefore, as important as it may be later on, it's not really a physical statement. It doesn't have the status of the law of nature, because it is built into the framework of the mathematics and not an equation of motion. And as I said, it is really just a contracted Bianchi identity, as we will see later on. So what then about conservation laws? Assume that the manifold has a symmetry, an actual symmetry. Remember, you know, I said that there are two things that happened to Noether's theorem. One was that we have now this enormous freedom to choose coordinates because the equation will look the same in all coordinates. The action, the equations of motion will look the same. This, however, we said, does not indicate a symmetry. It is just a relabeling invariant. It's a renaming invariant. It can only give us a Bianchi identity. And it does. And it did give us this. Okay? It did give us this. And then we said, but there can be circumstances where the manifold itself has a symmetry, where the manifold itself doesn't change in a particular region or in a particular direction or in a, you know. The manifold itself may have an actual symmetry, in which case it is true in the Noether sense that the laws of nature don't change for matter as you move from one place to another. Doesn't mean that the space-time is flat. It just means that the curvature stays the same. If so, we do expect a conservation law. So let us look now at this second circumstance, where actually physically we have a symmetry. So let's say that the manifold has a symmetry in this sense. Then along paths that are induced, that are tangent to a vector field psi, the shape of the manifold that is the metric does not change. So the assumption is that physically the metric doesn't change as we go along a vector field. Now that means that the linear derivative of the metric doesn't change. It means that as we go along the manifold, along the direction of a vector field psi, the metric doesn't change. Remember that saying that the covariant derivative of g with respect to a vector field psi is equal to 0 would be trivial. This is simply the statement that parallel transport is compatible, and that defining the shape of a manifold through parallel transport is compatible or identical to specifying the shape of the manifold through the metric. So that was not something that you could impose as a special feature. It's just the consistency condition between the metric and the affine connection description of space-time. No. What you need to what is a non-trivial statement is, what is a non-trivial statement is that the metric doesn't change along the flow, which is really to say that if you take your experiment and move it from one place to another, the laws of nature that you will find will not change. So if psi, but this is just so many words for motivation, that this is actually an equation that has consequences in the terms of the conservation law, we would have to prove. So let's prove this. If psi is a vector field that obeys this equation, and not every space-time has such vector field. In fact, a generic space-time, an arbitrary one that you just cook up like that, is very unlikely to have any such vector field. But assume it does have a vector field, at least locally, for which the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing in some region. Then we say that psi is a killing vector field, at least locally in B. Now, this is very useful, and we will now see directly why this is useful. Remember what the Lie derivative of the metric is. The Lie derivative of the metric is given by the covariant derivative of the metric plus, and then we have the covariant derivative of the vector field, covariant derivative of the vector field, with contracted with the true covariant in the field of the metric. This is generally how the Lie derivative operates on any tensor. First, it takes the tensor itself and covariantly differentiates it, and then it takes covariant derivatives of the vector field and contracts them with the various indices of the tensor. We had that just a few slides back. And remember also that those semicolons are optional for the Lie derivative. We also said already that this is equal to zero. Remember that this equation says that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero, which is the consistency condition between the affine connection and the metric description of the manifold. So that the fact that the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing, if it does, is the statement that those two terms cancel each other, right? This is a set of differential equations, in practice. If you're given the shape of the manifold in terms of the affine connection, the Christoffel symbol, then you can write down these differential equations explicitly, because you can write down what those covariant derivatives are. When this is a vector field, and this covariant derivative, has the Christoffel symbols in it, and then you get this condition here. Now it turns out that if you have such a vector field, such that the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing, then the energy momentum component of the energy momentum tensor in the direction of the vector field is conserved. By that I mean the following. Remember that for we define the energy momentum tensor. Remember how we did that. Now psi, our killing vector field, gives us a direction vector field. We can contract the energy momentum tensor with that direction vector field. And then we obtain a four vector, right? This is a twice contravariant, that's one covariant. The outcome of that contraction is one contravariant. Now, the claim is that if psi is a killing vector field, so these differential equations hold, then this p mu has this conservation law, p mu semicolon mu, which is equal to p mu nu psi mu semicolon mu. By Leibniz rule, this is two terms. It's this term where we covariantly differentiated t, leaving psi the same, and leaving t the same, differentiating psi, this is vanishing because the t mu nu has this equation. That was the Bianchi identity that we painfully derived over two pages. And that expression here is antisymmetric because of the killing vector differential equation. Whereas the t mu nu, again, it comes in very importantly, the t mu is symmetric. well, that's symmetric, it's anti-symmetric, the whole thing is vanishing, therefore. Therefore, we have this conservation law. At this point, you may say, wait a moment. How come this is a conservation law? But you're not saying that thing in you, semicolon you, is a conservation law. What's the difference? This just has one extra component, right? I mean, here we're saying that T mu semicolon mu is a conservation law. But we're not saying that this is a conservation law. True. This is a conservation law, and that is not. Let's see how that comes. How that comes about. So in integral form, in order to see that it's really a conservation law, we'd have to integrate the whole thing. So what we have is that if this thing is vanishing, and if it arises from a Killing vector field in this way, then we have that this integral is zero, obviously. But remember what this is, T mu semicolon mu. It is the divergence. It's a divergence of T, right? And we had that K mu comma a semicolon mu is the divergence of, with respect to the volume form, in our case, variable V, of K, which is D of I K omega. I hope you can see this.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. I don't know if Gauss notations exist. I'm sorry, I switched between. Maybe I switched between books or something. I don't know. I'm not looking at this. Okay, so but the main point is exterior derivative, which we can trade for, I mean, this is a co-boundary operator, we can trade it for a boundary operator, right? So this is this divergence, which is the D of the inner derivative, and that is essentially Gauss' law or Stokes' law, which is to say that we integrate over the boundary and then just have the I omega of P. Sorry. It should be consistent in this. Okay. Sorry. No, that was working. The omega, this one wasn't right. Okay. Right.
Okay, so that's that. Therefore, as much of the psi component of the energy momentum flow, I mean, you see, the psi vector contracted with the energy momentum tensor gives you essentially the flow of the energy momentum in the psi direction. So what that says is that this boundary integral is vanishing. Okay, so what it says is that whatever, you know, flows into that volume will also flow out of this volume, because, you know, that is a closed surface here. It's enclosing our region in space-time. Whatever IP omega is flowing into that region must also flow out of that region. And we will later see how that relates to energy or momentum, as it may be. And it can also correspond to neither energy or momentum. It can also correspond to angular momentum and so on. So we could now, for example, take our region B to be a huge box, which is a three-dimensional space, and then you have time surfaces, early time surfaces, final time surfaces, and so on. Decompose that entire box and then get a statement about what happens at this time related to what happens at that time, and that's the conservation. We will do all that later. There is another way of seeing the significance of the killing vector field, and that is by looking at a geodesic observer. Assume psi is a killing vector field again, which is to say that the mean derivative of the metric is zero with respect to the flow generated by psi. And assume that gamma is a geodesic which has a tangent vector u. Then it turns out that the quantity that you obtain by contracting the killing vector field with the tangent vector along your path is conserved along the path. So let's say you have a killing vector field psi, so your manifold has a symmetry in your region, and the symmetry is described by the vector field psi, and you are traveling on a geodesic path through that patch of space-time where the symmetry prevails. Then as you travel, you have a tangent vector, your velocity vector. Now you contract your velocity vector, you contract your tangent vector with this killing vector field here. Then the claim is that this contracted quantity is conserved on your path. Let's quickly check that. Here's the scalar that we obtained by taking the inner product, by contracting the psi, the killing vector field with your tangent vector. And now calculate the covariant derivative. As you travel along your path, how is that changing? Well, by the product rule, or the Leibniz rule, I think it's a little bit too late. Okay. This is just completely writing out what this is, right? And remember what that is here. This is the covariant derivative in a direction of u. But that direction vector is given by uk d by dx k. Okay? And remember that the covariant derivative is linear in any prefactor that you may have in here. So I can pull those uk coefficients of the direction vector in front. And that's what I did here, the uk in front, pulled in front. And then you have the covariant derivative in the direction of d by dxk, which is exactly the semicolon. Okay, that's that.
Because you have two vectors like inner product, like inner product in between them. I'm giving you an example in just a second. So then, what do you
get when you do that? And by the Leibniz rule, you get the covariant derivative of the psi, like this term here, and you get a covariant derivative of the u, that gives us this term over here. Now, this term here this whole term will vanish because the covariant derivative of psi with respect to k is anti-symmetric in mu and k because of the killing vector field equation. Remember, there was this anti-symmetry in the killing vector field equation. Anti-symmetric. Okay? So, yes. Mm-hmm, that's right. And, yes, that's right. That it carries through even when you raise one of the indices. And, here we are. So that's anti-symmetric. I mean, you can lower that one index and then make the argument. Whereas the U terms are symmetric, and so the whole thing becomes zero. And here we have a U mu semicolon K, but that means we are covariantly differentiating the tangent vector in the tangent direction. And that's vanishing because it's a geodesic that we are traveling. Okay? So we have that this scalar is conserved on our trip. So for example, just to give you an example here, you could do You could be lazy and just sit there. That's still a path, because in space-time, you're at least traveling through time. Okay? So that would mean that your geodesic actually has only a zero component and no space component. In this case, you're simply projecting out just the zero component of the psi. And what you find is that that quantity would be like an energy is conservative. And you're just projecting out the time component there. Well, we'll have much more to say about killing expectations for episode 4 today.
What would that be?
Tangent of a circle. Because the circle would be a geodesic on a 3-sphere, and then the radial specter would be one of the killing vector fields, right?
No. I mean, you can't say that, because you have to distinguish the sphere from the ball.
Mm-hmm.
In the sphere, you can't have a vector that is perpendicular to the surface, because the sphere is only two-dimensional. The tangent space is two-dimensional, and there is no third dimension in it.
Well, the thing about the 3-sphere, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, we will cover the case of spheres, because they are full of symmetries. They are not absolutely symmetric cases. One last comment here. Is do not think that those equations here can only describe energy and momentum conservation. In fact, they will also be suitable to describe angular momentum conservation. And that is because they are general enough to allow us to describe fields, and they allow us to describe symmetries of the metric, symmetries of the manifold that are rotation symmetries. So you could have, for example, that your manifold looks like a volcano, let's say. Okay. Then, as you travel this way or that way, there's no symmetry. However, if you rotate, it stays the same. So it could be locally like a volcano, for example. And you can find vector fields which induce a flow that just goes around, right? And so in the case of a manifold that has this volcano-type shape, you could find clean vector fields that describe such a flow. And then what you would get is a free conservation of animals, as we will see in detail. But do you have a question?
So here, the lie derivative, the Lie derivative of the metric is zero.
Yeah.
So that's our condition, and we are free to choose killing vectors. So that would give us, each killing vector gives a symmetry, right?
Well, the thing is this. A killing vector field is a vector field in whose direction the Lie derivative of the metric is empty.
Yes. So so basically, symmetry means a killing vector field.
Yeah.
From that. But can it mean another equation constraining G? Not the Lie derivative of G being zero, but another, can we imagine another equation constraining G giving us a symmetry?
Giving us a symmetry.
Yeah.
Yes. For example, you could have the space time has waves, and so it has a periodicity. In this case, you could get the same space-time if you did a finite transfection. Then you saw that wave crest goes to wave crest, goes to wave crest, and so on, right? So you could imagine that. You couldn't capture that with killing vectors, because they only care about infinitesimal changes. So yes, there can be symmetries that are not captured by the Lie derivative.
And they give conservation.
They would give a conservation, absolutely.
Even the biosymmetry that you just said would give?
Yes, even if you have just a symmetry that you can, finite translations, for example, that does work, yes. Mm-hmm. For example, in commencement methods, you have the loss momentum of electrons in a regular lattice. then you would have that the lattice. I mean, you don't have translation symmetry in a crystal, but you have, I mean, not continuous translation symmetry, but discrete translation symmetry, and that translates. Right, maybe you should wrap it up, and if there are further questions, I'm done.